Hello and welcome back to Heights Libraries Podcast, Unpacking 1619, where you can explore the interviews we've collected with scholars from around the country, in which we unpack topics relating to race in America. I'm your host, John Pichet, and I'm thrilled to share these interviews with you here. This week on the podcast, we begin our exploration of the intersections of slavery and medicine with my interview with Raina Hogarth, Associate Professor of History at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Here we are back in March of 2021.
I'm an Associate Professor of History at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. I'm trained as a historian of medicine and science, but my area of interest is the history of slavery and the construction of race in the Americas.
Great, and we're going to be discussing your book, Medicalizing Blackness, right?
Yes.
You came to write this, was this part of your thesis or was this a longer work?
Yeah, so this is actually, this is basically my dissertation. It's basically the blueprint. The dissertation serves as the blueprint for the book. And so, when I was in graduate school, I started going to archives and collecting data, I think probably 2009. So it did take quite some time to amass all of the data. The book was eventually published in 2017. So basically it was traveling to archives in the United Kingdom, in Jamaica, in Charleston, maybe taking myself around the Atlantic, that kind of arc of the Atlantic. And basically, I guess I like to tell people that as a historian, I'm a little bit of a nosy person. I read people's personal papers, their letters, their treatises. And so that sort of serves as my evidentiary base for the book.
Excellent. Yeah. And I mean, the research is amazing. And some of the things you uncovered are just really interesting. I think the first thing I would like to talk about is kind of, you mentioned two diseases that were kind of particular to slave culture in the British colonies, but also in moving up into the America once we became a country. And the one I knew about, which was the disease to run away from the enslaved, which I always thought was I can't remember what that one was called.
So drapetomania, which was coined by Samuel Cartwright, who was very much a pro-slavery physician. So to be very clear, we think with very good reason that his creation of the disease that causes slaves to run away had far more political, origins than medical or physiological. So I actually chose purposefully not to focus on that slave disease, and instead I selected cachexia africana, which is dirt eating.
Yes, and if you could kind of walk us through how that became a concept, and then also, what fascinated me was how you kind of marked that as the beginning of, or the continuation of, controlling Black bodies.
So cachexia africana is fascinating, actually. And to be completely honest, when I started this dissertation work, I did not think I would be spending so much time talking about dirt eating among slaves. So I kind of got there in a strange way. I was reading medical journals from the 19th century, and I saw references to cachexia africana, and it would sort of say, attended with dirt eating or dirt eating amongst slaves. So I was just curious because it wasn't a disease that I had necessarily heard of before. And in digging into these medical treatises and the descriptions of the disease, it became very clear that this was a racial pathology. So digging into the name cachexia africana, for example, that just translates to African wasting. Like that's literally what it means. And I knew that dirt eating does exist as its own disease entity. And now people would call that pica, and it's usually associated with malnutrition, or it's seen as a way to replenish minerals. But in the context that I was looking at, this was specifically discussed as a problem of slaves. And at first, physicians saw this as a disease found in newly imported Africans into the Caribbean, to the Americas. The idea being that they were so depressed, anxious and upset about being torn from their homelands that they would take to eating earth or clay. And this is, it's a wasting disease. And I should say that eating clay from the earth, this is not actually a good practice. It actually does indeed bring on death, but it also weakens the slave's body. If we think about this within the context of slavery in the Americas, this is clearly a problem for slave owners and slaveholders, because this means that their labor force is not actually able to labor because they are sort of weakened by this disease. So there is the theory that, well, perhaps this is, it's a kind of pathological depression, or that it is a deliberate practice in which slaves are purposefully trying to slowly kill themselves. Now, I should say this is not unheard of, because slave suicides were very common in the West Indies. Even before making it to the final destination of the Americas, there's ample cases of slaves throwing themselves overboard. There are ample cases of slaves once arrived, drowning themselves, just basically resisting. So for me, as the historian, I was very curious about the meanings of this disease, one in the sense that it seemed to directly harm the desires of planters, and that it made this labor force not able to work. It puzzled physicians because they just couldn't understand the cause of it. And I should say that many white physicians saw themselves as authorities. They felt that they could manage the health of the enslaved. They felt that they had this kind of power. And with Cachexia africana, that actually revealed how very little they knew. And I actually argue in the book that it helps to expose professional insecurities for some of these physicians, because, you know, they're getting paid to get slaves back into working order. Failure to do so means that they have failed in their jobs, and that can impact their reputation. They're not going to get paid. So for physicians, I started to see another narrative unfolding where they start to blame slaves for this practice, to suggest that they are doing it deliberately, or that they are consulting with enslaved healers, which opens up yet another narrative, which is to say, on the plantation, it's not just the physician. That's not the only medical game in town. Enslaved healers do exist. They bring with them their own knowledge. They bring with them their own approaches to healing and understanding sort of the body. So physicians now have to confront, one, they actually don't know what causes this disease. They're failing to stop it. They think slaves are doing this. And I should add, dirt eating is often done in secret. So slaves are not forthcoming. So they can't really figure this out. We remember in the West Indies, there's about 200 slaves on average on a plantation. They can't know what all slaves are doing at once. And then they now have to contend with the possibility that enslaved healers, perhaps obeah practitioners, are interfering in some way. So I thought this was such an interesting slave disease in the sense that it was basically a creation of the white medical imagination. They constructed this disease as a racial pathology. They claimed it was a problem of the Black body, that there's something wrong with enslaved people that led them to do this. So they went through all of this to create this disease, but that ended up revealing just how little they actually knew, and it frustrated them to no end when they were in trying to do their jobs on plantations. So it was really a fascinating kind of archival trip, like looking at papers. You know, you might see a reference to a person has died, and it will say dirt eating. You will see very highly trained physicians kind of throwing their hands up in their air saying, like, well, we don't know how to stop this. So I like the idea of Cachexia africana as possibly resistance, as a window into, professional struggles for physicians, as a sign of enslaved healing agency, that slaves can try to do things on their own and try to take control over their health, but also just in a sense of a racial pathology that, you know, they believe this existed as a disease. They cited each other. And when I talk about the United States, for example, Southern medical students wrote their dissertations on Cachexia Africana with the expectation that when I graduate from med school, if I am called to go to a plantation, I will be able to recognize this particular ailment and I will be able to find a way to mitigate its damage.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I found so enlightening is the way the, well, first of all, I think before we get into the physicians kind of putting themselves into the system of slavery, there was this question that I had, and I think other people may as well, was it actually something the slaves were doing, or was it something that was happening to them? Like, it was this dirt eating was being blamed for things that may have been a symptom of like bad treatment and malnutrition and that kind of thing. And they create, as you said, it's a figment of white imagination and the physicians. So maybe if you could kind of, yeah.
Sure. So this is actually quite tricky. So I will say this, we do have ample evidence to suggest that slaves were most certainly malnourished. They were most certainly not receiving enough caloric intake or vitamins and minerals as one needs. And this is very clear if we think about the amount of labor they were supposed to be performing and then what they were actually given to eat. There is no way that they were making up the correct amount of calories. And then if you think about the limitations of food, what kinds of foods they had, mineral and vitamin deficiencies are real. Now, it is possible, I think it is most certainly possible that slaves could have taken to eating earth and dirt and clay to replenish minerals. We know that pregnant women, even today, are known to engage in pica because it's a way to see, to get more minerals and nutrients. And we know that enslaved women were actually singled out, pregnant enslaved women were singled out for doing this practice. So I do think that there is something to be said that there could have been a true nutritional deficiency. But I say that knowing there are also a number of cases where physicians will note that sometimes slaves will take to dirt eating if there is, let's say, a new overseer that's put in that they don't like or that they're upset about something. And then when the overseer goes away, they stop eating dirt. So I also see this as a kind of negotiating resistance tool. If one of the key complaints or symptoms is that they can't work, they're too weak to work, it is not outside of the realm of possibility that slaves might also be doing this or feigning dirt eating so as to say, okay, I'm not going to work. And this will cause a panic amongst for the slave owner and for the physician. So is it resistance possible? Is it malnutrition? Very likely. Is it something that slaves can use to manipulate the circumstances? Yes, it can be all of these things. So this is sort of the fun part, but the challenging part of being a historian is that you can never know exactly what the motivation was for that one, you know, for the group of slaves that are on this plantation. You can sort of piece it together, and that's the fun part of reading the fragments left behind in the record and asking different questions, for me, that center the agency of the enslaved persons. So rather than just saying, okay, maybe this is just something that white physicians made up and they were unhappy, I can say, yeah, that's true. But if we dig into this, aren't we maybe perhaps seeing ways in which slaves resisted the system and ways in which they tried to push back against white surveillance of their labor and sort of control over their bodies?
And I kind of want to pick up on that white agency, or not white agency, the agency of the slaves versus kind of the development of the white physician. So if you could kind of unpack a little bit more about the slave healer versus kind of what became, especially in the South, the
sure.
You know, doctor.
Yeah, so what's interesting is that, you know, there had been a tendency, at least in like very like older history of medicine books, to sort of show us the terrible things that had been like sort of done to slaves, right? That they were these white physicians, they would go to the plantations and it was sort of, you know, was horrifying. We can see this kind of racism in action in the practice of medicine. And so then there starts to be this sort of turn in the historiography where it's sort of like, well, what did enslaved people do? Like, how did they respond to this? What about them as patients, but also as possible practitioner themselves? And with that kind of framework, I wanted to sort of ask questions about enslaved healers and this idea of slave agency. So for me as a historian, I assume slaves had agency, right? They were living, thinking beings. They had to make decisions. They had to negotiate difficult surroundings. So I know that their agency is there. It's just that it's not in the written record. It's just not anything that's necessarily written and left behind. So the challenge for me then was to read between the lines of comments about enslaved populations to get at or sketch out or reconstruct a possible way that slaves tended to sickness and tended to their own health needs. So for example, James Thompson is a very well-known physician in Jamaica, and he writes extensively about bird eating, and he complains about obeah, which is a kind of spiritual practice that slaves in the British West Indies, so in Jamaica in particular, some slaves, you know, followed this, right? And they would have a well-known obeah practitioner and obeah man sometimes who may use charms or sort of other objects in part of healing and possibly harming, right? It can do both. And that slaves might apply to an obeah practitioner if they have a health complaint or any other complaint, to me, I should say, is makes sense. That is sort of dealing with problems in-house within their own community, because they don't want the intervention and the outside surveillance of the physician or of an overseer or slave owner. So you have, basically for me, I see communities of enslaved populations trying to manage their health and manage their own sort of issues on their own terms. And really with these physicians coming in, they're disrupting that. So I like to say that slaves already were trying to tend to their own health care. They weren't just waiting for white physicians to show up and save them. That's not really how it works. What was interesting though to me is to see that white physicians thought that. They thought, well, we're trying to do our jobs and we're trying to help you. And I think for many slaves, they're like, you're actually not helping. And we would prefer to deal with this in our own way. And that tension is part of what I talk about in some of my chapters on Kekexi Africana, particularly in Jamaican plantations, where it is a clear contest for authority or for knowledge. The fact that physicians will try any kind of draconian therapy or any kind of practice to stop dirt eating. So for example, basically just like putting a mask over a slave's mouth and restricting their ability to eat anything, which is clearly punishment. Right. It is both punishment and sort of a way to prevent this, but it's again comes with the sort of relationship of domination and subjugation. And you can imagine that for enslaved populations who already have to deal with this day to day, it sort of heightens this and adds to distrust, adds to the resistance of these physicians. So the idea of the obeah practitioner that, I mean, for me, I feel like it must have kept some of these physicians up at night, as the kind of vitriol they have in writing about obeah, in writing about enslaved healers, and making claims that slaves are somehow backwards, or that they're engaging in this because they don't know any better, or they can't look after themselves. To me, it's sort of that revealing that kind of hubris and sort of not recognizing that slaves know a lot more than you're letting on. So that's kind of how I use those sources to try and think about enslaved people as autonomous beings who are very deliberate in some of their actions that they're taking.
And kind of as a side note, that it's interesting you brought that up, that idea of white fear of the enslaved population is a theme that has really come out in the last 20 or 30 years of scholarship. And I don't think I know when I was taught about slavery, it wasn't, you know, that, but that's a side note. But I wanted to move into now, and it does speak to the fear, kind of the birth of the hospital workhouse. And what there are two things. The first thing is, can you kind of walk us through how, the workhouse kind of led into the hospital and what a hospital meant back then, because it's not kind of what we think of today as a hospital.
Yes. So there's so hospitals, I should say, and I always have to kind of make this very clear. In the past, like I think I would argue, like, you know, before we get into the 20th century, like, so pre-20th century, nobody wants to go to a hospital. You get care in home. Doctor comes to you. hospital is the last resort, right? So this is usually a place, they're charity hospitals, they're places for sort of the poor, the friendless, the transient. If we go into the 18th century, it's not unusual to hear people referred to as inmates in a hospital. So just to make that clear, like for anybody, slave or otherwise, a hospital is not where you want to be. Now, if we add that on top of a slave society and we think about the function of hospitals in Black majority slave islands, there's a whole other layer of sort of power dynamic and sort of the politics of space in controlling bodies and sort of healing them. So using the example of Jamaica, which is what I do in the fifth chapter, I just had the question, right? It just started with a simple question of, okay, I know there were plantation hospitals, like, you know, hot houses and buildings designated for slaves, but what about slaves in urban areas? What about places where there wasn't necessarily a plantation hospital? How did you deal with sick slaves? And, you know, in other regions of the Caribbean, I should say, like in the French-speaking world or the Spanish-speaking world, you might have hospitals that are set up through the church. You might have something that was very clearly outlined as like a public charity hospital. But in Jamaica, that isn't quite what happens. And I thought, okay, well, Jamaica, Kingston in particular, there were clearly enslaved populations. This was a commercial center. What did they do with urban slaves that felt sick? And I was actually told, like, well, maybe there just wasn't a slave hospital. And I was not really satisfied because I'd seen like little references, like maybe there was a hospital or an asylum for enslaved populations. So I thought, okay, well, I did know that workhouses existed. Workhouses were essential to Jamaica. They are part of a very well-orchestrated penal system that is designed to correct runaway slaves, to house them, to put them to work. And again, these are Black majority spaces. So the idea of policing and confining Black populations is actually key to the survival of some of these islands, because the fear of slave revolt is real. And I should say that it is not an exaggeration when they claim, oh, the slaves are plotting to kill us or they're going to burn down the city of Kingston. I'm like, yeah, they are. They would if they could. So it's very adversarial. It's clear that there needs to be a way of corralling these Black populations. So I looked at workhouses, and this is when I went to Jamaica, and I actually saw that they did pay for a physician to come and see the inmates to offer care. So I was like, okay, well, this is getting me one step closer to like an urban setting to see how enslaved populations might have been treated. But I, you know, managed to do more digging and found that in the newspapers in Jamaica, they would list the names of slaves in the hospital and asylum for deserted Negroes. So for that, at that point, I'm like, why would you advertise a thing that didn't exist? So, you know, again, in Jamaica, I'm looking at vestry records, and I saw financial records. And as they always say, follow the money. So I followed the money. If the citizens of Kingston put aside money to create and build a hospital for these sort of the hospital and asylum for deserted Negroes, I'm like, well, they put their money where their mouth is. So they've advertised it. They have an overseer. They have instructions that the town guard round up all of sort of the transient slaves or Black people. It doesn't matter if you're a slave or not. You have to prove that you're free. But they don't assume that you're free. You have to kind of somehow prove it. Otherwise, they just throw you in there and you're confined. And it says, you know, for the care of these slaves, you know, to look after them. But it's very clear to me that if you're asking the town guard to round all of these people up, bring them before the magistrate, ensure that you have a watchman, have a record book of who is there, advertise the name of the enslaved person and to whom they may belong, this is surveillance. This is also like strategic surveillance in the sense that this serves the function that a workhouse would serve, right? So it's sort of like, okay, maybe you've committed no crime that we can charge you with yet, but we do not trust you to be out and about in the city of Kingston. We do not trust you to sort of be on your own. So we are going to confine you in this space. And as I said, a hospital, you know, you put the inmates to work if they're, you know, up and feeling better. So you keep them busy. And if you think about a slave society, I'm like, well, enslaved people, all their lives are work. They are forced to labor. This is like the regime of their life. When they're going into a hospital, supposedly to get care, it's like, no, you will continue this life of labor. So for me, I recognized that these spaces, this hospital, is not something that is motivated out of a humanitarian desire. It is a strategic and calculated institution that polices the movements of Black populations in Jamaica, particularly in Kingston, which again, if anything happens to Kingston, right, this is the commercial center, this is a huge blow to the island. So obviously the government, the assembly is trying to, you know, protect that. So they want to mitigate against any attempt at rebellion, or as they say, there was a plot to burn down the city of Kingston. And I believe that. Like, I believe that there very well likely was plots to destroy Kingston. So yeah, hospitals are not just that benign space or a charity space that one might think of. And that was actually quite a fun chapter to research as well as write.
And I assume it was fun too, because you were in Jamaica doing it, right?
Yes. Well, so I have family there. So it's kind of, you know, yes and no, because a lot of people say, oh, how do you find housing and how do you manage? I'm like, I have family there.
Well, and I would like to get now into the, you mentioned the in Jamaica, the lists of people, but the, one of the things that I found most interesting was how you used newspapers in the America to kind of like the doctor ads, the physician ads. And what I found so interesting was your point about how these doctors were on one hand saying we're experts, but on the other hand, sounding really desperate for business and like kind of trying to get themselves to be trusted, not by the slaves, but the enslavers.
Yes.
And if you could kind of talk about that and how hospitals developed out of that.
Sure. So yeah, what happens in the United States, or I guess the colony, well, I started sort of in the early national period. So looking at Charleston in particular in the 1790s and 80s. And so, yeah, what an interesting story that was. So I have to say, not a lot of folks have written about slave hospitals in the early national period. So again, I was kind of like wading into a sort of new sort of historical area. And yeah, newspapers are a great place to start. You know, perhaps it's just a weird quirk of mine, but I enjoy reading 18th century newspapers. I'm fascinated by like little snippets of life that you can kind of piece together. And so, you know, there had been an understanding that in at least in the United States, in the Southern United States, we have this very clear history of like predation on enslaved people's bodies, on Black people's bodies, that hospitals, medical schools were just seeking out and preying on Black people's bodies. And so I was like, I know that history and I understand that, and that's fine and well. But I thought, was it always like that? Like, you know, how did that work? How did we get to that stage, I guess, in the antebellum era? So in looking at some of the newspapers in Charleston, which I should say it has a very rich medical history. And I actually think of it as a fantastic colonial city. It's such an amazing history. But Charleston actually happened to have a very high concentration of highly trained physicians that came from Scotland. There's a huge, weird, like a Scottish sort of, I guess, diaspora maybe. A lot of Scottish physicians in Charleston, very learned medical society. So I thought, okay, fine. Charleston also happened to be the place in the United States that did receive a good number of captive Africans. Most went to the West Indies or Brazil, but if we're talking about mainland North America, it was Charleston. So it made sense to say, okay, well, how do you look after, again, urban slave populations, newly arrived Africans into the city? Surely there must have been hospital spaces for them. And it turns out there were. There were these sort of slave hospitals, private slave hospitals, basically started by, from what I can see in the historical record, individual physician entrepreneurs. In the sense that they would say, look, I can make money if I'm able to offer a space for the treatment of urban slaves, because there were indeed urban slaves in Charleston. And we do also see the new Africans or saltwater slaves coming in. So they, who would need medical attention, most certainly. So it's kind of a business venture in a sense for the physician. It's a way to make money. And some were very successful. I was able to sort of piece together the existence of a couple of these physicians. And what it seems to me is that at this time in the late 18th century, you know, physicians are starting to come into their own. They're not quite the kind of highly esteemed profession. Like many people might say, look, I can do it myself. Why would I pay for a physician? Slave owners, slave holders are particularly cheap. If they can pay for it in-house, if they can even rely on an enslaved healer, they'll do it. But if you have something, an ailment that requires far more care, right? You know, a kind of surgery, remove something, amputation, those sort of things, you do actually need to have a trained physician. For the cases of pregnant women, enslaved women, they did have so-called hospitals that, let's say, will receive pregnant women. The idea of, again, not out of humanitarianism, out of the idea that healthy children mean more laborers. So I started looking at these newspaper ads, and I was kind of taken aback a little bit by this sort of desperation of, they're like, we will offer this care, we'll do this, we'll make sure that they're watched and looked after and no expense spared. And again, you know, I wanted to be very cautious here and say, okay, this is not because they are deeply humanitarian, progressive thinking people. They need to make money, and they need to convince cheap slaveholders, cheap slave owners to say, okay, sure, I will, you know, allow you to look after, you know, my property, and you need to return my property back into working order. So what I saw then was an appeal most certainly to slave owners. These advertisements are targeted to slave owners. The enslaved patient is completely secondary. If they even are a thought, because what you're saying is, take them out of the plantation where they may have kinship ties, where they may have an expectation of care amongst a familiar environment, and say, no, we're going to take you away, put you into this space, which is also going to be surveilled, because they will say somebody comes to check on them so they can't leave, and being treated by a complete stranger. So it is clear that this is not about comfort or well-being of the person that ends up in the hospital. Investigating these hospitals made me think more clearly about how these hospitals then evolve when we move into the 19th century to kind of completely shift their tune, where they're actually not really about the slave owner or the slave, and it's about the medical profession and training on these bodies.
Yeah, one of the most horrific transitions, I think, is when you kind of talk about the slave cadaver and kind of what happens and how much of medical knowledge is based on what happened to deceased slaves at post-mortem, basically.
Right. Yes, that is. This is something that I'm happy to be joining, I think, a good group of other historians who are also paying attention to this work. And that is to say that, enslaved people's bodies are valued for their labor, the labor potential. And of course, their humanity is kind of always placed secondary. But when we start to think about the value of their bodies when they die, that there is still this kind of demand. And that is a demand that is for the benefit of the medical profession and the training of future physicians. And that becomes extremely clear in Charleston. Again, and I hate to pick on Charleston, it's a great place to visit and do research, but it does happen to have what they bill as the oldest continuously operating medical college. And the records there make very clear that they relied on enslaved people's bodies. Like, it's not a secret. They don't try to hide it. It's actually put in a newspaper. It's in the meeting minutes of the faculty. When they open the medical college, they basically say, we're going to be able to give Southern medical students access to the bodies they need to train to be competitive physicians. And we're going to do so because we're going to just use, like, quote, literally the colored population, and it won't bother anyone. Like, that's sort of like the next part of the sentence. It won't bother anyone. So I would say that, yes, if we are going to reflect on how medical knowledge is sort of produced, how medical training carries on in the 19th century, specifically looking at some of these places in the South, it is undeniable that the bodies of African-Americans, African-descended people, were essential to the enterprise of training physicians. And I would actually argue making Southern medical practice competitive.
Thanks for listening to Unpacking 1619. For more information on Heights Library 1619 Project Discussion Group, or to check out more interviews with scholars, please visit heightslibrary.org. See you next episode, wherever you listen to podcasts.